So Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. I'll hand you over now to Mr. W.
Right, good morning to everybody not involved in the scouting organisation. A question for you as we get started. Don't look it up. Can you remember where the book of Job takes place? Can you remember? I'm seeing a couple of nods. It was the land of Uz. The first week of that series seems like a long time ago. But even saying the land of Uz doesn't really get us very far. Neither the Bible nor any other historic source actually tells us where that was. It is mentioned a few times, but it might have been a nickname. It might have been referring to the land where Uz lived. Uz might have been a person. But we know it was sort of near Israel. We could throw a dart and probably get close on the map. Now, second question, harder, without looking. Can you remember when the book of Job took place? When those events took place? I'm seeing fewer nods. In fact, I'm seeing some head shakes, and that's the right answer. No, you can't, because the book of Job doesn't tell us when it takes place. There's nothing in the text. Now, we can read references to things like domesticated camels, and that can kind of establish a time frame for us. We know it was before Ezekiel, because Ezekiel mentions Job. And we basically end up saying, well, it was probably sometime during the book of Genesis, which in and of itself is a pretty long time frame. So it's quite a vague answer. I haven't forgotten, by the way, that we've moved on from Job. There is some relevance here. So I'm bringing this up. I'm going back to what Sarah said. When we come to the Bible, we're coming to one book with one author, with one wonderful message that goes all the way through it, but in its construction, it's many books, okay? It's a patchwork quilt. And what that means is you get different types of book within it, okay? And that's really important when you jump from something like Job to something like Luke, which we're going to be studying for the next couple of months. We don't know where Job lived. We don't know when he lived. Why? Well, because Job isn't that sort of book. It doesn't actually matter where Job lived and when Job lived. It might have been near modern-day Damascus or modern-day Petra. He might have been a peer of Abraham or a peer of Moses. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference. Because the book of Job doesn't set out to tell us any of that. It sets out to tell us about the behaviours and the speeches, the responses to that one specific set of events. Okay? That's what we're trying to do. And what matters when we study Job is that we hear and understand those speeches, we see and understand those behaviours, and where they gave them, when they gave them, is not important. The purpose of the book is wisdom. It's passing on that wisdom. And it's not history. The book that we're coming to look at now, on the other hand, is completely different. This book is going to give us the where. This book is going to give us the when. It is going to talk about Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Nazareth. It's going to anchor us in time by telling us not the number of the year, because calendars weren't really a thing, but it's going to tell us who was the emperor. It's going to tell us who was the king of Judea. It's going to tell us who was the governor of Syria. From time to time, it's going to be more specific than that as well. It's going to tell us what religious festival was taking place. And every so often, it's going to tell us specifically the day of the week. That's because this book isn't about passing on wisdom. This book is a history book. So the details matter. If you want people to read your history and understand it as history, as things that actually happened, that actually took place, then you have to talk about identifiable places. You have to talk about identifiable times, because what you're presenting is, this is what happened in that place at that time. Okay? So when we're coming to this book, we can't treat it the way that we would treat Job. And Luke actually tells us in these four verses how he wants us to treat this book. Verse 1, there are many accounts of the things that have been fulfilled among us. And so, verse 3, Luke decided to write an orderly account. Yeah? He's telling us right there, this book that we're about to study is Luke's account of the things that have been fulfilled. It's Luke's presentation of things that happened. It's history. So three questions for us to work through this morning. Firstly, who is our historian? Who actually wrote this book for us? Secondly, what exactly was his intention? How was he framing this history that he was writing? And thirdly, why does that matter? 2,000 years after the event, give or take, why does it matter who he was and what he set out to write? So first question, who wrote the book? And I realise this is easy. It's in really big letters just above the passage that we read in your Bible. So fine, he was called Luke, probably called Luke. Who was Luke? That's the real question. And to answer that, we can do a bit of detective work. He's given us some clues here. Look at the back end of verse 3. I, too, decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. So Luke wrote this to his friend Theophilus. We're going to come back to Theophilus in a second, but for now let me read you the first verse of Acts. In my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and to teach. So that's our clue, okay? At the start of Acts, the author reminds his friend Theophilus, who he's writing to, about the last book that he wrote him, which was all about the life of Jesus. I'm not giving anything away if I say that's the gospel, that's the book that we're about to read. So that's pretty conclusive, I think, that the same person wrote Luke as wrote Acts, okay? Two books, same author. And here's where that gets really interesting. By the end of the book of Acts, from what we call Paul's second missionary journey, but it's about chapter 20, Acts doesn't say, then Paul and his friends went there. What it says is, then we went there. Then we did this. It's a really weird shift. If you ever sort of read through Acts sequentially, it's a strange shift. Up until then, it's read like history. Then these people did this thing, and then this people did this thing. And all of a sudden, it reads like you've sort of come across someone's diary. Then we went there, and then our ship was delayed, and that sort of thing. There's only really one conclusion that you can draw from that, which is that from that point onwards, Luke was travelling with the group. The author of Luke and Acts was part of that group of people. He's saying we because he was one of them. He was going to those places. He was doing those things. Now, that doesn't get us an actual name. I hedged a little bit on the name, because what we do from there is we look through all of Paul's letters. We look through all the people that he talks about as being part of his group or with him. We get a list. And then we cross off the ones who are mentioned by name in that latter part of Acts, where it's the diary of the author. Obviously, it's not any of those, because they still get their name. And we get a very short list. One of the people on that short list is somebody who Paul describes in his letter to the Colossians as our dear friend Luke, the doctor. And then people who know a lot more about classical civilization than I do say, well, yes, not very many people had the skills to write a book like this. Look at the language. Look at the length. Look at the way it's all set out. You need somebody with quite a lot of education. And we look at that very short list and we see that one of them is a doctor and we say, well, that's probably who it was. And that's why we put the name Luke in big letters above the title. It may have been Luke, it may have been somebody else, but the crucial thing isn't the name. That really doesn't matter. What matters is, whoever wrote this book that we're studying, and incidentally Acts, they were part of that group, okay? They were we, from chapter 20 onwards. They were travelling with Paul. They were travelling with the early evangelistic church, right up until he went to Rome for his trial. And that's sometime around 65 AD, okay? So who wrote this book? What do we know for sure? There was somebody, probably called Luke, who was alive and was an adult during the late 50s and early 60s AD. We know that pretty much for sure. And we know that they went around with Paul on the mission during that time. Okay? So that's who the author of this book is. Now, our main question, what did he set out to write? We looked at verse 3 already. Luke tells us he set out to write an orderly account for Theophilus. Now, verse 4, he wrote this orderly account so that Theophilus could know the certainty of the things he'd been taught. If you read around this, you'll see that some people think Theophilus wasn't actually a person. This is what I was taught, actually, as a child. Because you could translate that as lover of God. Theo, God, Philus, lover. So perhaps this was a sort of open letter. Perhaps this was a history, and it's been dedicated to the reader. You know, if you're reading this, lover of God, you must be doing it. I don't think that actually anymore as an adult. I think when you read through it, the greeting suggests that this is a real person. We're translating it as most excellent Theophilus, but actually in the original Greek, that's quite a chummy way to address somebody. It's not quite the way that you would write it if it was an open letter. Actually, the thing that swings it for me is verse 4. Luke's writing this down for Theophilus so that he can know the certainty of the things he's been taught. That, to me, sounds pretty specific. I think Luke's got something in mind there. He's not saying, I've written this down, you know, so that all of you can have a guide. He's saying, I need you, the person I've written to, or this is how I read it, to understand, to be reminded right now in the situation that you're in, that these things are certain. I think you could still read it as a general address if you like to. Personally, that feels to me like Luke's writing to somebody who he knows is having a hard time. He's writing to somebody who he knows is having a wobble. Maybe he's having some doubts about the authenticity of some of the things that he's been taught. Maybe he wasn't having doubts, but he was finding the Christian life hard going. Certainly a lot of people would have been around that time. And maybe this book is written to reassure him. It's all worth it. Whatever it is you're going through, it's worth it because it's true. Either way, Luke's setting out to write this history. And in these four verses, he's given us a huge amount of insight into how he went about doing that thing. So I think a rough translation of these verses, verse 1, many people have written down their own versions of this story, which verse 2 they've got from eyewitnesses and early Christians. And so Luke, verse 3, because he'd looked into the whole thing, because he'd taken this very seriously, thought that he would write his own version so that verse 4, Theophilus could be confident in the facts. Okay? So yeah, if we're working backwards, that does imply something, doesn't it? Luke is throwing a little bit of shade here. Luke is saying, Theophilus, what you need is one account that is clear and tidy and that I'm absolutely certain is true. That's what I'm writing for you here. And the implication of that is that some of the other accounts that were out there at the time maybe weren't up to that standard. That's probably not something that should surprise us. Even hundreds of years after Jesus' ministry, when the Gospels that we have were widely known and very well published, people were still writing books about Jesus, purporting to be accounts of his life. He's a fascinating person. I guess I kind of get it. There's this really strange genre, we probably call it historical fiction now, but in about the sort of 800s, 900s AD, suddenly there was this rash of things called infancy gospels. I don't know if you've ever looked at these. They're crackers, some of them. So basically, people sort of read the gospels and went, there's this big gap between the nativity and age 12, pretty much. There's a gap there. So I'm going to discover what Jesus did between those two times. Some of them are quite dull, to be honest. Some of them are hilarious. There is one, if you're ever in the mood for a story about toddler Jesus taming dragons, let me know. I can hook you up. So if that's what people are doing hundreds of years after the event, okay, when the established gospels are widely known, it shouldn't surprise us at all that in the early decades after the life of Jesus, when people are just kind of coming to the cause and could potentially be steered in one direction or another, shouldn't surprise us at all that some people are trying to take advantage of that. Some people are writing accounts in a way that would suit their politics or their philosophy. Or some people are just having fun with it, exaggerating, making it up. And look, you know, when the truth is feeding 5,000 people with a couple of loaves and some fish, you can make up pretty much anything you want, right? And it's going to sound at least vaguely credible. There would also have been people who were genuinely trying to write the true story, but they made mistakes. Or actually everything they got was true, but they didn't get the whole thing. Maybe their motivations were good, and maybe everything they wrote was true, but it wasn't up to Luke's standard. Luke wasn't happy with the fact-checking. Luke wasn't happy with the completeness or the orderliness of it. That doesn't mean they were wrong, those accounts. But it does mean that Luke still felt a need. He saw a gap in the market for an authoritative history. Look at verse 3. He tells us he's writing the account because he personally has investigated everything from the beginning. He's not taking this on trust. He's rolled his sleeves up and he's done the investigation. He's done the digging. And in verse 2, he tells us what he's done. Eyewitnesses, servants of the word. That's who the truth has come down from. And so we can assume when he rolls his sleeves up, when he investigates carefully from the beginning, he's gone and spoken to those people. That's why we thought about who Luke is. That's why it was so important to establish this is a person who was traveling with Paul in the late 50s and the early 60s AD. Okay, that's why that matters. We don't know exactly when Luke wrote this down. There's a couple of theories. Acts ends with Paul in Rome, awaiting his trial. And ultimately, we know he'll go on to be executed. It's a very strange place to leave it, before the trial, before the execution. One explanation is, that's all the history there was at that point. That's everything that's passed. One explanation is Luke was in the early 60s in Rome, helping the church there, helping them to look after Paul while he was under house arrest, and at the same time writing Acts. And what happened? His history caught up with real life. He ran out of history, and so he stopped, and he published there. If that's true, and we don't know for sure, we know that he published his gospel before he published Acts. So the absolute latest he could have written his gospel would have been in the late 50s AD. Okay. Other people think Luke wrote these books later in life and just, for whatever reason, didn't want to talk about Paul's execution and trial. In which case, if he was an adult when he was traveling with Paul in the late 50s, there's a limit to how late he could have written this. But let's say the late 70s, maybe the early 80s AD. So realistically, when Luke came to write this book, it was any time from a few years after the crucifixion to at most 50 years later. The very earliest events in this book, which we'll start with next week, take place about 35 years before the crucifixion. So in the worst case, the absolute worst case that you can reasonably make for the gap between the very first event in this and the point where Luke wrote his history is 85 years. That's the longest it can be. Now, in reality, I think it was less than that, if you want my view. I think that Luke really did write Acts while he was in Rome. in which case we're talking considerably less time than that. We're talking maybe 60 years, 55 years, something along those lines, between the things happening and Luke writing them down. But either way, right, if it's 85 years, the worst case, many of the eyewitnesses to many of the events, 85 years between the earliest and the writing, 50 years between the crucifixion and the writing, many of the eyewitnesses would still have been alive. If you're saying 50 years, 52 years, 53 years, many of the eyewitnesses would have been alive to these events. And if not them, then people who heard directly from them, their children or their local community. Bear in mind, people didn't move. The vast majority of people were born, lived, and died in the same place. And their stories passed into that community. It wasn't like now with a much more a mobile population where your stories might get dispersed. Communities knew, and they would have heard it firsthand from this person. So when Luke was writing, and when Luke wanted to carefully investigate the facts, he had direct access to the eyewitnesses or to people who heard the stories directly from the eyewitnesses. That's what he's telling us in these verses. Now, if you're about my vintage or older, I'm not going to have to explain to you that a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy is not such a good thing. For those of you who are a little bit younger, before video and music were all delivered by digital streams and every copy was perfect, they used to come on analog media called tapes. And it was possible, if you had a double tape deck and if you could persuade your tape to survive, that you could make a copy from one tape to another tape. So let's say that you'd recorded yourself performing a dramatic reading of a public domain text, because copyright law is a thing, and your friend heard it. And your friend thought, I'd like that. You could make them a copy from one tape to another tape. But that copy wasn't as perfect, was it, right? The older heads remember this. Just by nature of the copying process, a bit of noise would creep in, a bit of definition would be lost. And if your friend took that copy away and played that tape to someone else and they wanted a copy, well, their best bet was to come back to you and get a copy from the original. But if they didn't know you or didn't feel they could ask, they would take a copy of the copy. And a bit more noise would creep in, and a bit more definition would be lost. And so it went on. For really rare things, bootleg recordings of concerts and things like that, I understand people copied these things, copies of copies of copies of copies of copies of copies. So much noise, so much of the original definition was lost, that by the end of that chain, you could barely hear what you were meant to be hearing. Yeah, I thought this analogy was so good that it was worth explaining to the teens and 20s about analog media. It's probably wrong, but the original, the eyewitness account, that is what a historian wants. That's what you get hold of. If you can't get that, then you want a first-generation copy. You want to talk to the person who heard it from the eyewitness. Now, maybe those first-generation stories will miss a little bit of the detail. Maybe they'll have a little extra added, but if you compare 5, 6 of them, you're going to get to the truth. Whereas if you're going to the copy of the copy of the copy of the copy, that story might have been lost. That's why it's so crucial when Luke lived, when he did his investigation. Because over the next few months, as we study this gospel, Luke's going to tell us some extremely unlikely things. So he's telling us right here, I went and spoke to the people who saw them. I went and spoke to people who heard the stories directly. I got the best sources I could. This is not a copy of a copy of a copy where the original story's been mangled out of all recognition. And that's particularly crucial because Luke is going to write down word for word conversations that Jesus had in private with his disciples. How can we believe the truth of that? It's right here. He spoke to the servants of the word. When he carefully investigated, these people were alive, and he spoke to them. We know he was traveling with Paul. So we know that he can't have been writing all that long after the events he's writing about. And in historical terms, it's an extraordinarily short period of time. To have access to these witnesses is extraordinary when you're writing history. And of course, we know if he's travelling with Paul, he was plugged in. He was pretty close to the centre of the early church. So he had access to the people who heard these conversations with Jesus. Just before I get to why it matters, I'm going to mention something that's maybe a little further on. You're going to hear this from opponents of the Bible from time to time. They're going to say, well, Luke obviously had access to Mark's gospel, and he just copied sections of it. If they've done their homework, the more sophisticated argument here, they're going to say things like Q manuscript and L source, and it sounds very impressive. Those are names that people have given to accounts of Jesus' life or early works that we've never been able to find, but we think probably existed from textual analysis. It's always really interesting to me that people throw this in like it undermines the authenticity of Luke, because look at verse 1. Luke literally tells us that he's seen other accounts of the life of Jesus. Luke says it up front. And there's a word for people who read the existing accounts, investigate the things they want to investigate, and then write their own account. There's a word for that. And that word's not fantasist. That word is not exaggerator. That word is historian. That is good, proper historical method. Historians who have access to primary sources, to people who saw it, or to first-generation copies, it is well known in history, in the academic field, that they write the best and most accurate histories. That's just fact. So I'm not really sure why it's meant to be a winning argument from opponents of the Bible, but next time you hear it, hopefully you have an answer. So why should any of this matter to us? Well, Christianity is a personal faith. I'm sure we're told this quite often, and normally when people say it, what they mean is, please shut up about it. It's your personal faith. Keep it to yourself. That's not what I mean. It's a personal faith because it's faith in a person. This collection of books that we call the Bible, from the account of creation to vision of the apocalypse, from the dense theology of letters to Romans and Hebrews to the instructional wisdom of Job and Esther, and every single piece in between, we sang about it already. All of this turns on one person. One person. Because if Jesus Christ wasn't born, if he didn't minister on earth, if he wasn't crucified, if he wasn't raised again, we are wasting our time. Wasting our time. It all turns on Jesus. And it's more than just the big picture. It's also the details. The life and ministry of Jesus answers so many of the Old Testament prophecies. It's the middle piece of the jigsaw that is the Bible. If this isn't true, we've got it wrong. That's what it all hangs on. Over the course of this series in Luke, we're going to be unpacking this. We're going to be showing what Jesus did, who he was, and how he ties it all together. And as we do that, we're going to read some really extraordinary things. We're going to see angels appearing to people with messages. We're going to see God acting directly to do miraculous things. We're going to see prophecies that were hundreds of years old being fulfilled in detail that is genuinely jaw-dropping. Actually, we're going to see all of that next week. And then it's going to get really, really extreme after that. So it's important that we understand, if it's written down in this book that we're studying, it's because a careful historian did good research. That's why it's there. It's because he read the accounts that were out there. He investigated and he wrote something simple, neat, and complete to be accessible and to be easily understood, to reassure his friend so that his friend could be certain. It might be an alien concept to us in today's society. Truth is a bit of a variable concept, getting to the point where even the term fake news is redundant, I think. It feels like every big news story, there are two sets of facts out there immediately, and people just choose whatever they want. Luke is telling us no. If it's written here, this is the truth, capital T. No matter how extraordinary the thing is that Luke's describing, we must be certain, certain that it's true. Jesus said these things. Jesus did these things. Those miracles happened. So our personal faith, our faith in the person of Jesus, which is based on these events that we read about, is in the right place. That's the message. That's why we're studying this. And as we go forward over the next couple of months, that's the thing you need to bear in mind. So what's the message for you this morning? Well, perhaps it's one of challenge. Perhaps you'd have come in this morning and asked me, what are you going to be saying? And I'd have said, well, the gospel is true. And you'd have said, sure, I get that. But do you behave like somebody who's certain? Certainty is a big word. Do you behave like somebody who is certain that every fact in this account is true? Perhaps that's the challenge to you this morning. Or perhaps it's reassurance. Perhaps that's the message. Perhaps as we go through this series and we look at these extraordinary events, the detailed history, perhaps from time to time, you'll find yourself needing to think back to this message and think, yes, okay. I understand the work that Luke did. I understand that by human standards alone, this is an extraordinarily accurate history. And maybe you'll be reassured then when we read some of the more extraordinary things. Or perhaps you're somebody who's feeling a bit like Theophilus. Perhaps this is a commitment you've made, but there are still some nagging doubts about the authenticity of the Bible. Or maybe you're having a hard time, and even though you would probably swear to the truth of the Bible, maybe you're tempted to give up. Well, this message is squarely aimed at you. You're who Luke was writing for. He wants you to understand that this is true. So as we're going through the book, as we're showing how the Bible, how the entire faith, how God's plan for all of history hangs on the person of Jesus Christ, Luke wants you to be certain of the facts. And if it's true, if you can be certain that this is true, then it's worth going on with. Or perhaps you're in that third category. You've never accepted that the Bible is true. And when we stand here and we say, all scripture is God-breathed, and therefore you can believe in the truth of it, you say, well, yes, but that's in the Bible, so I can't lift myself up by those bootstraps. Well, I hope that showing you that by human standards, this is an extraordinarily well-researched piece of history, that Luke had access to sources that most historians can only dream of. I hope that's given you something to think about as well. You don't have to believe, not yet, that the Holy Spirit guided Luke's hand when he was writing this. But you do have to believe that Luke, the historian, genuinely believed that he was writing truth. So as we go through this book, believe that this is a history that's been thoroughly researched. Believe that this is a history that's held to a high standard. Believe that this is what Luke considered, having spoken with the people who saw it, to be the absolute truth. That's the presentation that Luke wants you to read. And perhaps seeing it in that light as we go through, perhaps that will bring home to you who Jesus was and what he's done for you for the first time.